listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Jeff Dice with me today. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute. He's also the former chief of staff for Ron Paul when Ron was running for president of the United States. Jeff is a tax attorney. He is a believer in free market economics. Of course, he is the president of the Mises Institute, an institute that I highly regard and think that you should pay some attention to. It's Mises.org is the place to go to learn much about free market economics and a lot of very, very intelligent, very well-versed free market thinkers that that are there that give their ideas, and Jeff is amongst them, leading the pack. Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Excellent. Thanks. Good to see you, Jay.
It's really good to see you. On everybody's mind these days, interest, at least people that are investing in the markets, interest rates. Interest rates have started to rise. We've had decades of declining interest rates when the Fed has pumped huge amounts of money into the markets, distorting the interest rates, which have really robbed savers and have rewarded those that are able to have access to easy money, enriching themselves. And it has caused all manner of distortions in the markets, as the people at the Mises Institute understand very well. We've had, though, recently a rise in the interest rates. Interest rates have started to rise, and I believe that's occurring because of a shortage of savings overall in the United States. Who wants to buy treasury rates at zero interest rates or close to it, negative in real terms? And so there's a shortage of buyers of interest rates, and so the rates have started to rise. I'm wondering if you have a view on that. Do you believe that we are starting a new interest rate, a new regime of rising interest rates possibly? Do you have any comments on that?
Well, interest rates usually go up during depressions. And I think despite all the machinations of central banks around the world and governments on the fiscal side around the world, I think we're in a very serious economic recession, if not depression, brought on, of course, by the government shutdowns surrounding COVID. So there's no question that that's putting upward pressure on rates. And look, you know, governments and central bankers can suppress rates with respect to the overnight borrowing, the Fed funds rate, for example. They can push sovereign debt into, you know, even nominally negative territory. But when it comes to actual commercial banking, you still have to have creditworthy borrowers. And even throughout this huge experiment we've had with Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke and Yellen and now Powell, you know, subprime borrowers, the poor guy or gal who goes to the rent-a-sender or who goes to the shady car lot, they've still been paying 20% on their debt or their you know, subprime credit card. They never benefited in the way that the Cantillon effect benefits Wall Street. So you still have to have creditworthy borrowers. And as a business practice, commercial banks still have to make a couple of points of profit above their own costs of capital. So I think it's going up. I think interest rates ought to go up. I think they should go up. I think if central banks got the hell out of the way, they certainly would, because I certainly believe that capital accumulation is at the heart of really what gives us, at least on the material side, a civilization worth living in. And people need to be paid money for putting capital at risk. This ultra-low interest rates has caused huge distortions, which you mentioned. I think probably the largest of which, in the United States anyway, has been to push an awful lot of money into equity markets.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's no money to be made in safer and more traditional alternative vehicles. So that explains, in my opinion, a lot of, you know, the FANG stocks and the Dow and the NASDAQ that we've, I guess, enjoyed over the last decade since the crash.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people forego the consumption, the pleasures of consumption now need to get paid for it. Otherwise, they won't save. And so we've had this massive distortion. So in your view, certainly my view, I'm guessing you may agree, that we've had a massively overvalued equity market. When interest rates are so low, you know, the net present value of an investment, it changes things dramatically. So let's say that interest rates start to rise. I mean, Alistair McLeod and others on my show are of the opinion that that interest rates could get away from the Fed. As you point out, the Fed can control the short end of the yield curve to an extent, but longer term, not so much probably, because ultimately, you know, people, you can't fool Mother Nature forever. So what do you think, how do you think this might impact the markets, and not only the markets, perhaps the way people behave and live their lives, if in fact interest rates are starting to rise and get out of control of the Fed?
Well, obviously it's frightening, because interest rates rising, I think, will go hand in hand with inflation. And I'm talking about real inflation. They've done a good job of hiding it and masking it and BSing us with CPI over the last couple of decades. But if you read the book When Money Dies by Adam Ferguson, you realize just how devastating it is to people, not only economically and financially, but culturally, morally, to live in a time of hyperinflation. I don't think we'll see that in the United States, at least not anytime soon. But nonetheless, it's very, very severe, and it changes the way people have to think about everything. And so I think it's going to cause a flight, you know, at first in the cash, because uncertainty, like the COVID shutdowns, always causes people to hold more cash. That's called the yield for money held. And Hutt wrote about that extensively. It's nothing to be feared. It has a salutary deflationary effect on things, to fight all the Fed and central banks' inflationary pressures. So that's a good thing when people hold more money, because they don't know what's coming. Will they have a job, for example? So that's salutary. But at some point, if prices really start to rise, all that cash has to go somewhere, because people don't want to be holding cash and losing money. And some people speculate that that's what's responsible for a lot of movement into certain stocks. That's what's responsible for a lot of movement into Bitcoin, is many people's opinion. So, you know, money flows regardless of what government and central banks try to do in terms of manipulating people. Capital goes where it's treated well. And people aren't going to sit around and accept, you know, less than 1% maybe in a money market fund. So what it's going to do is going to turn us into consumers rather than savers, like our grandparents were, for one. And it's going to force us to go out there and chase yields just to tread water. And I think that's the hallmark of a very unhealthy society and a very unhealthy economy.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been true. That's been happening for decades, Jeff, in a growing degree, consuming, not savings. And, you know, I think it's the economist Roach from Yale that talks about these days about the enormous amount of a lack of savings overall. You know, when the United States government goes into debt and borrows, it's true that individuals are saving now because of COVID and the fear of the future. But the government, overall, our economy as a whole is way behind the curve. We're not saving nearly enough to fund the enormous amount of money that's being created, the debt that's being laid on the balance sheets of the Fed and the banks. So something's going to give here, Jeff. You know, it's hard to know which way it goes, I guess. But as you're hinting at sort of a deflationary possibility, a financial deflationary possibility, I suppose. And then what happens? The Fed is going to just start printing even faster, I suppose, right? Isn't that usually what they do?
Yes, I think so. I think Alan Greenspan put us on a new path forever and ever. 1987, the infamous Greenspan put, I think, is really the time when America fundamentally changed financially. Maybe that date, 1987, is even more important than 1971, when foreigners could no longer redeem gold for U.S. dollars. So I really think that 1987 action by Greenspan told markets that now forever and ever, we're going to effectively put a floor on what you can dump these stocks for. So don't worry, wink, wink, nod, nod, equities are where it's at. And I think that skewed things in favor of equity markets enormously ever since then. And I think people have responded rationally in a sense to that.
Yeah.
And what worries me so much is just that people aren't going to be able to keep up. I mean, the amount of time the average guy or gal can put into watching markets, reading about inflation, caring about what the Fed is doing, is very, very limited. And even professional traders oftentimes lose their shirts against algorithms. And, you know, T. Boone Pickens didn't call the huge oil fall a few years ago, you know. So it's very, very difficult for the average Joe. And it forces people to go out there and try to find ways to survive. And maybe, you know, if I were smarter, I would make a bet on deflation versus inflation winning out, because I just don't know, because these things are, you know, dependent on what billions of people get up every morning and do. They're dependent on central bankers and governments. And so we have these two opposing forces. You know, people aren't traveling. They aren't going out to eat. Many people have lost their jobs. Many people are staying home. Many people are no longer renting office space. All of that is hugely, enormously deflationary. Supply chains are screwed up. But on the other side, you have governments and central banks using every fiscal and monetary tool at their disposal to exert inflationary pressure. So I don't know how that ends. I don't know how that works. If I did, I suppose I'd be out there with my E-Trade account getting rich.
Yeah, well, what I hear you saying is what we've created through this false monetary system, this fraudulent monetary system, in my view, is a gambling casino, essentially a gambling casino. And those people who have the time, who have the capital, who can sit there and you know, move money around, are the ones that seem to be getting rich. This distortion of interest rates then has caused money not to go to productive sectors, but to sectors where the rich keep getting richer because they own the casino, essentially, and they are able to become enriched. There's another aspect that you mentioned to me the other day about what we might be looking forward to now with the new Biden administration, and that is tax increases on equity earnings, on profits from the stock market. Would think that would have some impact on how people invest going forward. But as a tax attorney, I'm guessing you have some thoughts about that.
Well, during his campaign, Biden certainly, on his own website, demonstrated a preference for raising taxes on capital gains and potentially changing the longstanding tax treatment of carried interest, which is, of course, the basic business model of private equity and venture capital firms, to pay capital gains rather than ordinary income rates on the money that those fund managers are pulling out of funds. So that would be a sea change. And it would also suggest that maybe going forward, the difference between the tax treatment of income and capital gains is going to be reduced, which might make people more interested in investments with some sort of income stream, like a royalty stream from a mine, for example. But if we go back and think about it, you know, what created this mania where everything's just a capital gain? If the only reason you buy a stock, which is becoming an owner of a company, let's not forget, used to be to get income. You wanted income from that in the form of a dividend, and then later you might sell the stock and hopefully at a gain, but that wasn't necessarily your primary concern. And so if we get a little more granular, forget investing in a public company on the stock market. What about just starting a business? Let's say an individual wanted to start a dry cleaner or a restaurant in their town. Well, usually they might go to the local bank and borrow, not issue equity, but borrow $50,000 or something from their credit union. And pretty soon they would need to have actual operating revenue, positive cash flow, not only to service that debt, but to pay themselves. So they'd have to pay off that loan. And, you know, they didn't operate a restaurant to just simply make no money and sell it 10 years later or 20 years later with some exit strategy. They have kids. Those kids need to eat. They need to pay a mortgage. Maybe they need to go to college. So they needed to pull money out of that restaurant or dry cleaner pretty quickly after starting, within, let's say, a year or two. And yet somehow, because the tax treatment of interest, which is deductible to corporations, versus the tax treatment of dividends, which is generally not deductible to corporations, it really skewed things. So we have this mindset where, hey, I'm just going to buy a stock and I'm going to hold it for a long time and I'm going to pay the short-term capital interest rates when I sell it because number go up. Yeah. And Greenspan basically said, yeah, as long as I'm around, number go up.
Yeah.
So it created what is, in effect, a pyramid or Ponzi scheme where there always has to be a future buyer willing to pay more. But that's not really a capital market per se. That's not the function of capital markets, which is to allocate capital to its best and highest uses, you know, reward good management, punish bad management. Right. Instead, it's become this speculative thing where even blue chip companies like Amazon, which has been public since the late 90s, can go decades without earning a profit and still see its share price go up and never pay a dividend. No, investors aren't clamoring for dividends. Nobody invests in Tesla or Facebook because they want a dividend. So this strikes me as a tremendous perversion of what capital markets are supposed to be and do. And I think that we need to, I hope that collectively as a society, we need to begin to understand why interest rates exist as signals of a sort, why people should be paid money for saving and investing, and why we should actually get back to this old-fashioned idea of, you know, you look at your revenue and you look at your costs at the end of the year and decide whether you had a good year or a bad year, as opposed to just all these people, these MBAs, simply looking at the underlying share price of a company. You know, this to me is we use this term very generally, but this to me is the financialization of the economy, and I don't think it's good or healthy.
No, not in the real world. And then, of course, the Greenspan put, which has been succeeded by every other Federal Reserve chairman's put, means that if there's no buyer, if they can't leave the Ponzi scheme stop, so they pump more money into the system so that they're sure to have more buyers to buy these overvalued instruments. So it is destructive, I believe, very much, very, very destructive. But I want to thank you, Jeff, because I think you're giving us some ideas about how we should be looking at the real world through the eyes of a free market analyst like yourself. I think that there are opportunities if you can recognize the pathology of interventionism that is also of value. So I think you're helping us in that regard. The idea would be to go back to free market economics, honest monetary system, where average people would be playing on an even playing field, where the rich and powerful wouldn't be in a position to continue to get more rich and more powerful and control the monetary, the political system as well, which I know you're very well aware of as well. Just one more thing, Jeff, before we complete our discussion today. Frank Holmes is coming on right after you on the show, and Frank is a believer in gold. He's got his fund. He has a number of funds that invest in gold mining companies. He has a couple of ETFs. He's also involved in cryptocurrencies as well. Frank is involved in a company that is mining Ethereum, and a public company is actually making money doing so. Very interesting story. But I know you have some thoughts as a tax attorney, as someone who knows what governments can do with law and tax law. How do you think governments are likely to treat cryptocurrencies that might be seen as competing against their fiat currency system?
Well, they're going to react badly, I think, for starters. We've already seen Elizabeth Warren open her pie hole just the other day about cryptos, and we've seen Janet Yellen say some very dumb things. I'll only speak to Bitcoin because that's the only crypto that I care about or think about or study and personally invest in. And I get a lot of grief from the Bitcoin community because I'm still old-fashioned about gold. I think those two things can be actually complementary. I think they can coexist, and I'm not quite ready to just throw it out the window after thousands and thousands and thousands of years of never going to zero, which you can't say about any stock or currency or company, for example. So I get a lot of grief from the young guys in their 20s and gals who are, of course, convinced that Bitcoin will make gold obsolete. Maybe it will. I'm not smart enough to predict the future, but I will say that I think governments are going to do what they can. Let's hope that the blockchains work in a decentralized enough fashion that as long as there is good internet somewhere, as long as there's electricity capability somewhere, that governments are going to have a hard time seizing or corralling or regulating or controlling Bitcoin. It remains to be said. I will say they'll probably do everything in their power. And maybe that means rather than confronting it head on with, let's say, criminal prosecution, maybe they'll try to co-opt it and do a shady end run through the IMF or some similar agency developing its own digital currency or cryptocurrency. So that, to me, is a real danger. And I certainly hope that people don't fall for this nonsense, because they used to talk about special drawing rights
Yeah.
And a new global reserve currency using a basket. And that basket was just designed to get political compliance because they'd include the dollar, they'd include the Chinese yuan, et cetera. These people are nefarious. They're up to no good. And whatever they try to do in the digital or crypto space, I wouldn't trust them as far as I can throw them.
Yeah. So I think that's wise advice. Jeff, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. It's your insights are always appreciated. And it's reasons.org where people need to go to gain the insights of the free market Austrian economic theories. Thank you, Jeff, for being with us.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back with Frank Holmes.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSXV and GTBAF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their district-scale Dixie Project in the renowned Red Lake Mining District of Ontario. Having made multiple high-grade near-surface gold discoveries, GBR's capital efficiency has allowed them to be fully funded to complete a very active 300,000-meter drill program through 2021. Stay up to date on what's been considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 3 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.